Loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it gives me great pleasure as always to join you on this week's episode of our journey through the Bhagavad Gita. We are in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita and we've more or less crossed the halfway mark of the chapter. As we've been seeing, this chapter concentrates on what Krishna refers to as the vibhutis of the Lord, where he speaks of the various aspects in our life where you can recognize the presence of the Lord, the glories of the Lord being expressed, and more importantly, answering to a question that Arjuna raised in the early part of the chapter, where Arjuna said, "Tell me more about these vibhutis, contemplating on which I can move closer to you." And that has been the theme of what Krishna is speaking in this part of the Gita, where he says, "I will talk to you about those pradhana vibhutis, those prominent among the vibhutis, contemplating on which you can understand me better, because it is not possible to tell in detail about all the vibhutis." And that is the portion we are going through. We covered two shlokas, 21 and 22, last week. A few parts of 22, I should say, because one half of the 22nd verse is yet to be covered, and we'll do it today before we move to the other shlokas. Since Krishna had said that there are many vibhutis, but he will speak of the prominent ones, much of what Krishna says is probably understood by Arjuna, or for that matter, anyone from that period in time who had a frame of reference to whatever Krishna is explaining here. For example, Krishna speaks about the Adityas, the Maruts. We had to spend some time understanding who they are and what is the role that they are meant to play according to the epics, according to the Puranas. We had to do the exercise of trying to understand that. But when it comes to someone like Arjuna, he kind of understands what Krishna is talking about merely when he refers to these names. So first we had to understand what are these terms that Krishna is using, and among them, why is Krishna pointing out to one entity as his vibhuti? Another point is, when we talk about the Adityas, the Maruts, or Rudras and Vasus, whom we will be talking about today, these are all deities assigned to certain natural phenomena, right? They are, in that sense, what are referred to as adidaivas, and we had a reference to that in one of the earlier chapters. And Krishna had very clearly already stated that the Supreme Lord is the one who works through these adidaivas. So all Adityas, all Maruts, Rudras, Vasus, Indra, and the other 33 crore deities, as they say in the Hindu pantheon, all of these adidaivas are nothing but expressions of the same Supreme Lord. So in that sense, all these are vibhutis of the Lord. But even among these vibhutis, some stand out and are worthy of contemplation and study. And doing that helps us go closer to the supreme understanding. And that's the whole point, Right? So coming back to the shlokas that we were doing last time, Krishna says, Adityanam aham Vishnuhu. Among the Adityas, I am Vishnu. Adityas are the children of mother Aditi, and Vishnu is her youngest son who is born as Vamanavatar, right? We also discussed how he represents that Upanishadic phrase, Anuraniya Mahato Mahiyan, which Krishna had already mentioned. That is one of the descriptions of the Lord worthy of contemplation, worthy of Anusmarana, right? And we saw that connection between that shloka and the one we were studying. Then he goes on to say, Jyotisham, among luminous celestial objects, Ravihi Ashuman, I am the radiant sun. Though sun or Vivaswan is also an Aditya in the sense that he is son of mother Aditi, he is spoken of as a special Vibhuti when it comes to the bright objects in the sky, not as an Aditya. Because among Adityas, Krishna says, I am Vishnu. But this Aditya, which is the sun, I am a special Vibhuti in the form of the sun when it comes to the luminous objects in the sky. Then Krishna says, Marutam, of the Maruts, Marichihi Asmi, I am Marichi. We discussed the births of the Maruts, the deities that govern all movement, that is winds, storms, movement of the clouds, movement within us, breath, and all other kinds of flows that happen within us, which we associate with the five pranas. All of that is governed by these Maruts. And Marichi is the Marut that is otherwise called Parivaha. And this Marut forms the connection between the Jivatma and the Paramatma. We also discussed the deep symbolism in this whole story of Mother Diti conceiving the child in order to kill Indra, and they being split into the seven Maruts by Indra, and Indra giving the boon that when they come together, they still can overpower him. Even though Indra set out to kill the Maruts, he, you know, splits them into seven pieces. That's how they become seven Maruts. But then he also gives the boon to Mother Diti, saying that, Mother, don't worry, your initial desire still can be fulfilled, in the sense that they still can be stronger than me, but for that they have to come together. And we discussed how this is a symbolism for what forms the basis for the yogic approach to spirituality, where the five pranas are first of all balanced, then they are brought together at the Agnya Chakra. The Agnya Chakra is considered to be the home of this Marut, which is referred to as Marichi or Parivaha. And the references earlier in the Gita, where Krishna said all the pranas have to be centered on the portion between the two eyebrows, Bruvoho Madhye, which is the Agnya Chakra. So some of these very subtle symbolisms are conveyed in some simple statements that, I would say seemingly simple statements that Krishna makes here. In the 22nd verse, Krishna says, Vedanam Samavedaha Asmi. Among the Vedas, I am the Sama. We again discuss the significance of this. It is because Samaveda is itself considered as an expression of Udgita or the Pranava Mantra. And that is why Samaveda has a special place, because the essence of Samaveda is supposed to be Udgita, Pranava Mantra, which Krishna said, I am the Pranava in all the mantras in the Vedas, right? And that is the connection to what Krishna is saying here. The other way of looking at what Krishna is saying here is, which is also a very significant interpretation, when you see all mantras, or what we refer to as riks, essentially they are all different forms of prayers. They are all chantings or mantras that you recite in the form of worship. And when you look at Samaveda, Sama is considered to be considered the musical Veda, or the Veda from where all forms of music has originated. So Samaveda is almost synonymous with music. And this is again a reference to what Swami would often say, the best form of prayer is prayer that is expressed or encapsulated in music. And that is one more reason why Krishna says, among the various forms of worship, I am that form which is musical. You could say that that is one of the ways of looking at this statement that Krishna is making here. We covered till this point in the 22nd chapter, as I was saying, the second line of this 22nd verse, second line was left out. I will start with that before we move to the other shlokas. So in the 22nd shloka, he then says, Cha and Indriyanam, among the senses, Manaha Asmi, I am the mind. Krishna says, I am the mind among the senses in the body. There are 11 senses in all, the 5 Jnanendriyas, the instruments of cognition, and 5 Karmendriyas, the instruments of action, and the mind. So there are 11 senses in all. And in some of the earlier chapters during our discussions, we have discussed this concept of why the mind is considered supreme among these senses. Because if you look at it, all sense organs are only probes or measuring instruments, right? When the eye sees, they just capture what is seen. It is just a few forms that are captured, like simply like a camera, right? And what it captures is very different from what we quote-unquote perceive, right? What we actually see is different from what the eyes see. There is no sense of proportion, distance, pleasant, unpleasant, danger, or this is something that I need to go towards. This is a happy scene. This is a sad scene. The eye does not make any distinction like that. The eye just registers the image in front of it. All these perceptions happen because of the mind. Similarly with organs such as the ear. The ear only records decibels and various sounds. The ear cannot understand language. It cannot listen to somebody's words and say, oh, this is abuse or this is praise. The ears can never do that distinction. The ears only collect sound in the form of waves, right? It's just the mind that does this decoding and then of course it reacts and then we are propelled to action. That's a different point. So it is the mind that makes sense of whatever the senses present to this individual. It is the mind that constantly decodes it processes all this information and then says that this is good, this is bad. It takes all this data and makes a cohesive narrative. If the mind is switched off, that very moment you find that all senses become useless, right? That is why it is said that when we say senses, it is the sense organ plus the mind. When we say the sense organ of vision, it is the sense organ of the eye and the mind. When we say the faculty of listening, it is a sense organ of the ear and the mind. And whatever faults that one does, when Swami would say senses are leading man astray, it is not that the senses are leading man astray. It is the mind that is leading one astray, isn't it? Similarly, it is the mind that makes us make good use of the senses too and move forward on the spiritual journey. So that is why Krishna says that when you look at the senses, the karmendriyas, jnanendriyas and the antakarna, I am the mind. The final point that Krishna makes in that 22nd verse, a very important one is, he says, Bhutanam, among the living beings, Asmi Chetana, I am consciousness. A statement that is very important. And if you take just this for contemplation, I think it will reveal so much into the nature of God, the nature of the Bhutas or the beings. And most importantly, we understand better how we operate, isn't it? What is this Chetana, as Swami is saying here? Chetana Shakti, a word that Swami would often use in his discourses too. It is sometimes translated as Buddhi or intelligence. Many commentators use that meaning in this particular shloka, saying that, among the beings, I am the Buddhi. That's one way of looking at it. But Chetana, if you really look at its essential meaning, you find that Chetana expresses itself as Buddhi in some life forms. Because Chetana is the substance with which all living beings are made living beings, if I could put it that way. A couple of weeks back, I made a reference to some of the scientific experiments with life, right? Where scientists have come to a point of almost creating self-perpetuating RNAs. And that's as close to creating life, they say, that the scientists are coming today. When I quote scientific studies, I'm doing it with the disclaimer that my knowledge of them is very less. And even as we speak about it, there may be advances that have come in that field. So with that caveat, this is one of the studies which has come. So I can set off a sequence of actions. When we talk about any other form of actions that we do, right? Why is it so difficult to create? Why is it such a big deal that self-perpetuating RNA has been created and it's been spoken of as a great breakthrough? There are many actions that I can set off physically. Like, you know, I throw a ball, the ball lands on something else, it then pushes another plank and the plank turns a stick. You know, what you typically call a Rube Goldberg mechanism. But what we are actually doing there is only setting energy in play. And that energy, when I throw a ball or when I'm pushing something, I'm just converting this energy and it acts on the potential energy of the object involved. And that is converted into kinetic energy at each stage. There is a loss of energy. This is simple high school physics, right? Energy gets converted from one object to the other and there is dissipation of energy. Until the dissipation of energy is unsustainable, you will have these sequence of events happening. But this is not a self-perpetuating system. When we talk of life forms, or even living cells for that matter, not a complete organism, they have mechanisms to sustain themselves through a process of finding energy for themselves from around, isn't it? Talk about plant forms or animal forms. They have the ability to gather substance from outside, either gather energy directly or gather energy in certain way as food, as sunlight, and create some form of energy from within, right? And this is what we refer to as life, as sentience. What that life form does thereafter depends on the natural limitations of that entity. For example, a plant, it can create energy, but it cannot move, right? It cannot locomote. An animal can locomote, but they have other limitations, like advanced reasoning is not possible. Advanced speech is not possible. When it comes to man, the same Chetana Shakti now can animate him in such a manner that these advanced activities can be carried out. Just like the difference between, say, a simple light bulb and the television. The same electricity can only give light through the bulb, but the same electricity, when it passes through the gadget called TV, it most certainly lights up, but then there is sound, and what it creates through that gadget is much more advanced. It creates in us happiness, it creates in us learning, sadness, anger, but the electricity is the same. And life is not merely this self-perpetuation. That is only one of the qualities. Maybe we can still create at some point in the immediate future a system that can sustain itself, right? Maybe we can create a gadget like that, or we can even, through the advances in biology and bioengineering, create a cell or a tissue which is self-perpetuating in that sense. But when we talk about life, there is self-perpetuation, self-preservation, and perpetuation and preservation of another kind that ensures continuity and progress of the species itself, right? It ensures that that intelligence is passed on. A simple bird, if you were to observe it, as soon as it hatches, it pretty much knows what it needs to do in those next few moments. It responds to the call of the mother bird, and it probably starts to walk. So there is a passage, there is a transfer, I should say, of intelligence from that one generation of that species to the new one. So Chetana Shakti is the sentience that makes all of this possible. It expresses in various ways depending on the level of that life form, right? That is why there is a very beautiful and profound statement in the Keno Upanishad that says, Chetanas Chetananam, right? Chetanas Chetananam. God is the sentience in the sentient. Now, why is this contemplation important? Why is Krishna mentioning this as one of the vibhutis? As we said, when he mentions anything as vibhuti, it is meant to be studied, contemplated upon. So why is the contemplation of this concept of Chetana important? I see the body, the physical body, as achetana, insentient, right? It is just material, it is just matter. And life that animates it, we see it as Chetana or sentient. So like the analogy I've given before, in some other context, let's say you have a pair of gloves. A surgeon wears it and performs a complex surgery. We don't go and applaud the gloves. Left alone, the gloves will simply lie limp on the table. Because the hands were used inside it, they could accomplish this complicated surgery and save the patient or whatever. But can we say that the hands did it? Yes, the gloves did not do it, but can we say that the hands did it? Well, not really. Just like the gloves, the hands also are only a prop. The mind of the surgeon works through her or his body, bringing to play the knowledge gathered by the mind, isn't it? But can we give all the credit to the mind or the brain that represents the mind? It is the Jivatma that operates through the mind-body complex and performs actions and also thinks, isn't it? Now, Krishna is saying here, I am the Chetana in all beings. If you think about it, this Chetana or consciousness is itself a tool for the super consciousness, isn't it? When you look at this individual sentience, when you look at the body as achetana, then this jivatma becomes chetana that operates through this material body. If you were to consider the jivatma itself as achetana, not capable of operating on its own, if that is the definition we give for insentience, if we were to look at this jivatma itself as achetana, then something is operating with this as a prop. So the consciousness, the individual consciousness, becomes a tool for this super consciousness. That is why Chetana is also translated as will. In higher life forms, like the human form, the same sentience or Chetana becomes individual will, or what you otherwise call free will, right? If you observe animals, the intelligence of self-perpetuation and self-preservation is completely programmed or hardwired into this body-mind complex. But in human beings, the same Chetana Shakti also manifests as the will, the choice as to how one wishes to lead one's life, right? Though much of the self-preservation and self-perpetuation is still hardwired, right? That is why that is the animal part of the brain that doesn't go away so easily. But there is also manifestation of this free will. And this is what causes the illusion that I act or I desire and I am the one who is doing this. But this will is itself only a reflection of this super consciousness on the mind. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is this very beautiful conversation between Yajnavalkya and various other scholars of the land. The story goes that King Janaka, he is performing a yajna and he makes an announcement that I'm going to offer 1,000 cows decorated with gold ornaments to anyone who is prepared to teach me about Brahman, who is prepared to give me Brahma Jnana, right? Though in that yajna, many great scholars and many great jnanis have come together, no one dares to claim that I have enough knowledge to be able to grant Brahma Jnana to the king, right? So everyone is hesitant, nobody comes forward. And to the scene comes this great sage, Yajnavalkya. And he comes, and in a very casual manner, he commands his disciples, okay, go and take all the 1,000 cows and take them to the ashram. That is the confidence with which he enters the scene. And at that time, the scholars get quite enraged and they say that this is, this is nothing but ego. He thinks that he can do it. So they decide to test his knowledge by asking him various questions. And that is how this entire section of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is documented. The conversation between Yajnavalkya and the sages who are trying to question him in very, very deep and profound philosophy. So this is one of the questions that is put to Yajnavalkya, and I'm going to read out this portion from Swami's Upanishad Vahini, where Swami writes about this dialogue. Swami writes, and I quote, "The next to accost the sage was Bujju. His questions were, is there an entity called God or Purusha who rules the senses and who is not entangled in this current named life or samsara? Or is there no God of this type? If there is one such, what are his characteristics?" Yajnavalkya answered him thus, "Your Atma is the entity you inquired about. Just as a wooden contrivance cannot operate on its own, but must be moved by some outside power or inside force, or just as this arm cannot move, or just as this arm can move like this only when the will operates on it, so too, unless a super spiritual power presides, the body cannot act and the vital airs cannot function as they do. He is the seer of the seeing function of the body. He hears, not the ear. The super consciousness, Chetana, that sees and hears and feels is but a reflection of the Atma on the mind. The super consciousness sees even the seer. What happens is that the consciousness reflected in the mind moves out through the senses and grasps the external world of the five elements. So it appears as if the consciousness is engaged in activity. Really speaking, it has no activity. The consciousness or Chetana is the Atma. It is beyond the reach of the senses. It is above and beyond the subtle and even the causal bodies." End of quote. So this is from the Upanishad Vahini that Swami has written on the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the chapter. So consciousness can also be seen as awareness, right? The point that till now we saw is Chetana as sentience. And so beautifully in that Upanishad, that portion that I read out, the reply given by Yajnavalkya, there is the super consciousness, which is one with the Atma. The Atma is what reflects on the mind as the will, and the will operates through this body-mind-senses complex. And that gives this illusion of doership. But all through, it is that super consciousness that operates, and that is one of the reasons why contemplating on this Chetana can give us a very deep understanding of who we really are and who God is. But the same word, Chetana or consciousness, we can also speak of it as awareness, right? We say, I am conscious of that, which means I am aware of that. Or we speak of bringing something to the consciousness of the people of the land, means making people aware of a certain event, right? So we speak of something coming into my consciousness. So Chetana is also described in that sense as awareness. But our awareness is always limited to the experiences that this body-mind complex goes through. And as the body-mind complex becomes more and more capable through this evolution of life forms, we see a more advanced awareness. And that is why the awareness in the human form is much, much more than the awareness probably in rodents or in reptiles, isn't it? Because as the body-mind complex evolves, the same Chetana Shakti is able to express as higher forms of awareness. But this awareness also, if I were to give you an analogy, it can be seen as the ocean. And the awareness that we experience right now is like taking a handful of that same water. There are similarities between the water I hold in my palm and the ocean. Probably it'll give you a sense of the same consistency, the same taste, but there is vast difference between the water I hold in my palm and the ocean. So that is the difference between the awareness that one feels within this body-mind complex and the awareness that is available to one when one transcends this body consciousness. But essentially, it's the same Chetana. The reason I went into that long explanation of that one statement is, it's a very, very profound statement that Krishna is making when he says, I am the Chetana in all life forms. It means so many of these concepts. There are various layers to understand, and that is why the statement of calling the sentience in the sentient as my vibhuti is a very, very important point to contemplate upon. So coming to that shloka, this Chetana, which is so critical, is a special vibhuti of the Lord, which should be deeply contemplated upon. With that, we'll move to the next shloka, the 23rd shloka. We'll listen to it as always in Brother Shyam's voice, and then we will discuss in detail what Krishna is conveying there.
Rudranam Shankarashchasmi Vitesho Yaksharakshasam Vasunam Pavakashchasmi Meru Shikharinamaham.
Krishna says, of the Rudras, I am Shankara. Of the Yakshas and Rakshasas, I am the Lord of Wealth, Kubera. Of the Vasus, I am Agni. Of the mountains, I am Meru. Krishna continues in this shloka, making reference, as we discuss, based on some common knowledge of that time, right? So first he makes a reference to the Rudras, a concept that is differently described in various Puranas. But one of the most popular accounts is that Rudra is born as half man and half woman from the anger of Brahma, right? Because we always associate the Rudra form with anger. So it is said that it is born, this half-man, half-woman form is born out of the anger of Lord Brahma. Then the male part and the female parts split. The male part of that form further splits into 11 more beings. And these 11 beings are referred to as the 11 Rudras. Swami would often say in his Shivaratri discourses that these 11 Rudras represent the 5 Karmendriyas, 5 Jnanendriyas and the Buddhi. That is because Brahma makes these 11 Rudras the deities of these inner instruments. All Vedic references to the Rudras are invariably to their anger and rage, and there are quite a few rituals that are centered around appeasing these angry gods, right? If you want to live a peaceful life, find ways of appeasing and placating these gods who represent anger. Krishna states, Rudranam Shankaraha cha asmi. And among the Rudras, I am Shankara. It is said, Samkaroti iti Shankara. Shankara is he who blesses or he who brings auspiciousness. So you could say of all kinds of anger and rage, Krishna is saying, I am that anger which results in auspiciousness. Anger can also be a blessing, and as we have seen with Swami all the time, Swami's anger is always only a blessing. It is only a form of his divine grace coming in a form that is not loving, if you could put it that way, as we define loving as. But anger of Swami is always beneficial, right? So when Krishna says, Rudranam Shankaraha cha asmi, one of the ways of probably understanding that is, I am Shankara. Shankara here refers to Shiva, right? Lord Shiva is supposed to be one of the Rudras. And his anger always benefits his devotees, benefits mankind. So among the various forms of anger, I am that anger that brings benefit, brings benediction and auspiciousness. Then Krishna says, Yaksha Rakshasam Viteshaha. Among the Rakshas and Rakshasas, who are again celestial beings that are considered to be little higher than humans, but not high as the gods or devatas. So they are considered semi-divine, the Yakshas. And some of the Puranas describe the Yakshas as those that are very fond of wealth and hoarding them, right? Among such beings, Krishna says, I am Vitesha, I am Kubera. Kubera is supposed to be the king of these Yakshas. So I'm sure there is something to be learned from the qualities of Kubera, because of which he is being mentioned as a Vibhuti. Many of the epics and Puranas, the Mahabharata for instance, you have references to the Yakshas, right? Because the Yakshas are considered to be, they are made caretakers of certain wealths. For instance, there would be one Yaksha who is governing one forest. There would be one vast lake which is under the care of a Yaksha. That's how you have that story in the Mahabharata, right? When they go to drink water in a lake, they're not surprised, because it is quite common that there would be these Yakshas, Yakshaganas, or they are otherwise called, that would be in charge of some of these natural resources, or there would be a cave with a lot of wealth and there'll be a Yaksha guarding that. Because Yakshas are considered to be, in certain Puranas, beings that are very fond of hoarding wealth or protecting wealth, and that's why they are made caretakers of this. So Kubera is also one of the Yakshas. So Kubera is also can be defined as one who is keen on hoarding wealth or who enjoys being affluent. So what makes Kubera stand out? There is a very interesting story in the Mahabharata. I think there are many versions of that. Kind of gives an example of the nature of Kubera, right? The story goes that after the war, Yudhishthira and his brothers find out that there are many portions in the kingdom, the vast kingdom that was being ruled from Hastinapura. The many portions in the kingdom where they have been suffering from famine and drought for a few years. So when they take over the kingdom, they realize that, you know, there has been these segments of the kingdom which have been suffering, and the rulers at that time, the Kauravas and Dhritarashtra, have not taken care of that. So Yudhishthira, being a very noble king, he says the first thing we need to do is try to help these citizens who are in these famine-stricken regions. But they come to a point where they're not able to help them much, because the coffers of the kingdom itself has been, you know, very badly pulled down because of the war and everything. So when they approach one of the hermits in the kingdom asking them for advice, the hermit says that why don't you go to Kubera, the lord of wealth, and seek for some help. And he gives him the whereabouts where he can find Kubera. They say, you know, he lives in this Himalayan region and you can go and ask him and he'll surely be very happy to help you. So Bhima is given the duty of going to Kubera and putting forth this prayer, hoping that Kubera will help them with some relief material which can be sent to these famine-stricken regions. So Bhima goes in search of this Himalayan city where Kubera is living. And he comes to this huge granary where Kubera stores all the grains that he has accumulated. So even as he is entering, Bhima is very hesitant, you know, because he has heard some tales about Kubera's miserliness, and that's how he has become rich, right? As I said, as a yaksha, he loves to hoard wealth. And Bhima is not too sure that Kubera is going to help them, but he's come all the way. And he sees the scene that there is a man who is sitting down on his knees and he's picking out grains from the sand, right? So there are many versions, as I said. One says that one of the sacks opens up and spills on the sand. So Kubera himself gets down and starts picking out grains one by one. He doesn't even want to waste one grain. The other story is there is one sack of rice which has too much sand and the attendants of Kubera want to discard it. But Kubera says, no, no, you should never discard rice. Even if you can get a small heap from that sack of sand-filled sack, it is worth it. And that's how Kubera gets down himself and starts picking out grains one by one. So when Bhima looks at the scene, and he's all the more convinced that Kubera is not going to help him. He said, such a stingy person, such a miserly king, how is he going to be letting go of some of these grains of rice? So even as Bhima decides to leave the place, Kubera looks at him and he recognizes that Bhima has come to him, and he comes running to the entrance and very warmly welcomes Bhima inside. And then asks Bhima what has brought him to his place. So then Bhima explains the whole thing and he says, the Emperor Yudhishthira has sent me to you and with a prayer that you help us with some, you know, grains which we can send it to these famine-stricken regions. The moment this prayer is put forth to Kubera, Kubera gets up and he orders his men take, 500 cartloads of rice and you take it down immediately. Right now start loading all these carts and take them to the region. So Bhima is quite surprised, and when these instructions are being given, one of the attendants, one of the ministers of Kubera comes to him and says, we have one problem, that one of these roads that leads to this particular region has been washed away because of bad rains, and the carts may not be able to pass through that region because of the swamp. And immediately Kubera says that if that is the case, empty a few sacks of rice, few sacks of grains on that road and level the road with that and then proceed further. We don't have time to, you know, go and fetch sand or something and repair that road. So let's do this and so that we can take the rice grains to the people as soon as possible. Bhima, who sees this whole scene, is so flabbergasted, he's so surprised. Looking at the expression on his face, Kubera asks him what happened. And Bhima confesses that in the beginning he did not think that Kubera will help. And all the more he was driven to that thought when he saw Kubera picking out grains from the floor himself. He thought that he was too miserly. But here Kubera was ordering that empty sacks of grains so that the road can be leveled and the grains can be taken. So he's wondering, he said, what is your true nature? Are you miserly or are you one who is ready to give? And that is when Kubera says that, see, I certainly am a hoarder. You know, I am one who preserves wealth because I know the value of these grains. I know the value of wealth. So in that sense, I ensure that I do not waste even one grain when it comes to that. But the true value of grain, the true value of food, is that it can quench somebody's hunger. It can satiate someone's hunger. So that grain, which is used in whatever way to satisfy the hunger of someone, has served its purpose, right? So what is the point in me having all this grain if it cannot be used to give relief to the poor? So when it comes to giving relief to the poor, you should do whatever it takes. But when it comes to preserving, when it comes to protecting, you have to be very thrift, right? So this is the lesson that Kubera teaches Bhima. This is the story from the Mahabharata, which shows that among the yakshas, among those that hoard, why is Krishna saying that I am Kubera? I'm just thinking out aloud. Maybe Krishna is saying, among those who give too much value to wealth and hoard wealth, among those that become rich through such pursuit, I am Kubera, who is the lord of wealth, but also knows that the true purpose of such wealth is to be used for others. Right? So Kubera is also described more as a trustee or a caretaker of wealth that actually belongs to God. So maybe Krishna is making a reference to some of these noble qualities when he says, among the yakshas, I am Kubera. Then Krishna goes on to say, Vasunam, among the Vasus, Pavakaschasmi. I am Pavakaha. Pavaka is another name for Agni. So among the Vasus, I am Agni. Again, another set of divine beings that are often mentioned in the scriptures. There are supposed to be 8 Vasus, and these are elemental deities. Among them, Krishna says, I am Agni. Even among the 5 elements, right? When we say these are elemental deities, the Panchabhutas also are one of the 8 Vasus each. So even when you look at the Panchabhutas, or the 5 elements, Agni is often considered to be quite significant and quite unique, because among the gross elements, it is supposed to be the most subtle, and among the subtle elements, it is supposed to be the most gross. So it is often considered as the medium or connection between the gross physical world and the subtle heavenly world. And that is why the idea of a havis, right, a sacrifice or a yajna is always centered around Agni. These 8 Vasus, the 11 Rudras that we spoke about, the 12 Adityas which were mentioned earlier, 7 or 9 Maruts, are all various deities that are mentioned in the Karma Kanda of the Vedas, right? That portion of the Vedas that speak about how you do various rituals and how do you appease them. If you want a son, what kind of a yajna you should do. If you want a victory in your battle, what kind of yajna you're supposed to do. And these are all addressed to some of these deities, the Rudras, Adityas, Maruts and Vasus. Whenever Krishna mentioned the worship of lesser deities or devatas, it was a reference to some of these, right? Because of the ritualistic approach or ritualistic worship is meant to appease them and gain boons, we kind of get carried away by the powers that they represent, right? So what Krishna is telling is these are all meant for deeper study and deeper contemplation. Why is it that I am Agni? Why is it that I am Marichi? Why is it that I am Vishnu among the Adityas? I am the sun among the bright bodies in the sky, and so on and so forth. The last statement that he makes in this verse is Meruhu Shikarinam Aham. Among the mountains, I am Meru. Shikarinam means among the peaks, right? Shikara means peak. Among the tall mountains, or those that you can be referred to as peaks, he says, I am Mount Meru. Meru, again, is a name that often occurs in the epics right from the Sagar Manthana, which I'm sure most of you might know. Meru is considered the king of all mountains, and again, represents all the wealth a mountain stands for. Often, mountain is spoken of as a giver of natural wealth, right? It is even in the when you talk about Krishna's life, why Krishna says that let us worship Govardhana, because Govardhana is the source of all our wealth. It gives grazing fields for our cattle. It gives us all the medicinal herbs. It ensures that we get rain in the form of rivers and rivulets. So a mountain always stands for natural wealth. And Meru is represented often as a mountain of gold, right? That's a very symbolic way of saying that all mountains are providers of natural wealth, and the king among them is represented as a mountain of gold. So the point that Krishna is making all through these statements is all fame and those qualities that lead to that fame are all to be considered as the vibhutis of the Lord. We'll dwell on that a little bit more, but before that we will listen to the next shloka, the 24th verse of the 10th chapter, and then we'll discuss in detail about it.
Purodhasancha mukhyam maam Viddhi partha brihaspatim Senani namaham skandaha Sarasamasmi sagaraha.
Among the priests, O Arjuna, know me to be the chief Brihaspati. Of generals, I am Skanda. Of reservoirs of water, I am the ocean. So that is the 24th verse of the 10th chapter. Generally, when we see a person who has achieved a higher status in life, someone who has raised oneself to great heights in a field, we very naturally tend to get a bit jealous of that person, right? That's pretty common, and I think very spontaneously we become envious. With a little bit of buddhi, with a little bit of understanding or discrimination, we know that it is wrong to be jealous. We all know that. Anybody who is introduced to Swami's literature, we all know how Swami, how much Swami speaks about the dangers of jealousy. But the question is, how to sublimate this emotion? It comes very spontaneously. What am I supposed to do about it? Though it can be overcome by one thought or, the way to resolve it, the best way to resolve it is what is being spoken of by Krishna here. If you were to generally observe yourself when you become jealous of someone, you know, when you see somebody who's doing really well in life, or someone who's, as I said, raised oneself to a status that is enviable, immediately the mind starts to look for flaws in that person so that we can tell ourselves, you know, after all, that person is not so great because he or she has these flaws. We had discussed this when Krishna had told Arjuna that he's explaining all these things in detail to him because he does not have asuya or jealousy. And why was that statement important? Because not having jealousy can be spoken of as overall purity of the mind because of this nature, that when we are jealous or envious of someone, we very spontaneously try to look for flaws in that person. It's because we try to resolve this envy that arises in us, looking for flaws in the same person, envy or jealousy becomes even more dangerous. The effort is only to resolve the jealousy, but that effort itself is making jealousy more dangerous. A better way to resolve this jealousy that arises in us is this contemplation of the vibhutis of the Lord, right? And that is why this is very important what Krishna is saying here. As I said last week, when we were discussing about the topic of Indra, every person who is in an exalted position with whatever superior qualities are there because on account of divine grace. So if we can try and see God's vibhuti in talent, in excellence, in fame, in authority, the jealousy will be resolved without making the mind further impure. In the same approach, Krishna says, Purodhasam cha mukhyam mam vidhi partha brihaspatim. Purodhasam, among the priests, Purodhasa is a name used for priests who officiate in rituals, especially those that help with doing yajnas or some family events, right? You always call a purohit or a pandit when you have a family, be it a marriage or a naming ceremony, or you want to do a Ganapati homam before you enter a new house. The word purodhasa means he who helps you gain punya in the future, right? And that's what an officiating priest does. He facilitates this process of trying to gain punya. So purodhasa, the word itself means he who helps you gain punya in the future. So Krishna says, among the purodhasas, among the priests, mukhyam mam vidhi partha brihaspatim, know me, O Partha, to be the most important among these priests, and that is Brihaspati. Brihaspati, who is considered to be the chief priest of the heavens, right? Again, the point that I was just making, looking at anybody who has reached an exalted state, instead of being envious of them, look at that state gained by them as a vibhuti of the Lord. Of course, it is not an easy thing. It is not going to happen overnight. Jealousy is not something that can be dealt with one thought or one day's practice. That is why this whole contemplation is supposed to be taken up so that we are able to resolve that jealousy in the right way. Similarly, Krishna goes on to say, Senaninam, among the army generals, Aham Skandaha, I am Skanda. Skanda, as we all know, is another name for Lord Subramanya, who is the general of the divine army. That's why he also has the name Devasenapati, the commander-in-chief of the Deva army. Then Krishna goes on to state, Sarasam, among the lakes or reservoirs of water, Asmi Sagaraha, I am the ocean. Another beautiful point. The oceans are the enormous expression of water reservoirs. Sarasa, the word sarasa actually can be used for any stagnant body of water, from a puddle to a pool to an enormous lake. So among bodies of water that are stagnant, Krishna says, I am Sagara, the ocean. Because the ocean represents limitlessness and being independent of any other source of water, right? So when you talk of any puddle of water or a stagnant pool of water, which is useful to us, right? Almost every stagnant body of water, other than those which you find in the potholes in your road, most of them are useful, and even those which are found in the potholes of the hole are useful to some other life form, I'm sure. Some birds or something must be drinking from that. So any stagnant body of water is useful to us. And among those, I am that ocean which is an infinite expression of all sarasas. That's why he says, Sarasam Asmi Sagaraha. So that is the 24th verse. I was going to take the 25th verse also, but I think I'm already running out of time, so I'll probably retain this for next week. As we can see, the general idea of whatever Krishna is saying here is this most important thing. Swami would often say this, you know, any number of times, especially when Swami would speak to Swami's students, Swami would address this issue about getting jealous of another person. And you would find this, much of the caviling that happens, much of the gossip that we do behind someone's back is born out of this jealousy. When you find somebody attaining fame, when you find that somebody is excelling in what he or she is doing, the mind automatically tries to look for some flaws. Because there are two ways of raising yourself. One is through effort, you raise yourself. The other is mentally you raise yourself by putting down the other person. And that has very, very serious implications in this spiritual journey. And these contemplation on the vibhutis that Krishna is speaking about here is very important and very critical in that sense. As I was just saying, it is not going to come in one day. This is a tip that Krishna is giving that needs to be contemplated upon. And we have to make a habit out of this, that every time we see someone in authority, someone in power, someone in an enviable position, some are so talented, right? How beautiful it would be when we are able to see a talent of a person and spontaneously we are not filled with envy and jealousy, but we are spontaneously filled with the thought that I have seen an expression of our Swami. How beautiful it would be if we see goodness in someone, if we see excellence in someone, and it triggers this thought, right? So this is the practice that we have to do, right? Just like how we have done so many practices, you know, oftentimes when we used to go for games in school, when you're in the cricket field, one of the difficult things is fielding practice, right? When a ball comes to you, you should be able to catch it. The only way is you practice so hard that this scene of a ball coming towards you triggers this action of your hands going in a certain form, and it has to become all spontaneous. In the similar way, we are trying to see that we are trying to achieve this state of excellence where the moment you see something good in someone, the moment you see someone excelling, someone succeeding, that should trigger this idea that, oh, I have seen a vibhuti of the Lord, an expression of the glory of the Lord in this person. That is the better way of resolving this jealousy which otherwise arises. So with that, dear listeners, I'll conclude this week's episode. Thank you for joining me as always. If you have anything to anything to share with me, if you feel that any of the explanation that I've given is not complete, comprehensive, or you need more clarification, you can always feel free to write to me directly at prem@ssmediacenter.org, or you can write to our listener feedback, or you can even send us a message to the WhatsApp number. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. I'm going to have a file played out for afternoon satsang. I'm not going to be coming to you live. Hopefully next week I will do something live on afternoon satsang as well, but I'm not committing to that already. I am preparing something. We hopefully will be able to do a live afternoon satsang next week. Till then, please put up with us. I most humbly offer this effort, and I am ever so grateful to all of you for your company. Till I meet you all next Thursday at 10 a.m. Keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.